I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's, an all-natural, raw pet food company. Marie started the company in 2003, and Stella and Chewy's products are found in over 500 stores across the United States. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. It's nice to be here.
What makes Stella and Chewy's different from other dog or pet food products?
Well, probably the main thing that makes it different is that it's an uncooked food. Other pet foods are processed at very high temperatures. That's how you turn something into kibble or into a can where it can stay on a grocery shelf for months, years even. So they're cooked at high temperatures, and cooking things at high temperatures kills enzymes and amino acids. So the idea behind Stella and Chewy's is to simulate how pets would have eaten in the wild.
How did you come up with the idea for Stella and Chewy's?
Actually, Stella and Chewy are my dogs, and Chewy was very sick. And I was reading a lot about the raw diets for pets, and to me it made a lot of sense. It wasn't reinventing the wheel. It was really going back to how pets would have eaten in the wild and how their ancestors continued to eat. And so I put him on a raw diet, and it was remarkable the changes I saw in him. And at the time, there was nothing like it on the market. And I was living in New York City, and I felt like if people only knew, they would want to feed their dogs this way.
What was wrong with Chewy that you put him on this raw food diet?
He had distemper. His immune system was compromised.
What were you doing at the time when you were caring for Chewy?
I was working in the fashion industry as a sales rep. And so I traveled a lot, and my whole life other than work was the dogs. I was single at the time, and I spent a lot of time with the dogs. And they were very, very important to me. They still are very important to me, but they were especially important to me at that time in my life. And, you know, watching Chewy get better and watching him recover from something the vet said really he probably won't recover from was really a life-changing event for me. And I knew that other people cared about their dogs the way that I cared about my dogs. And I wanted them to have the opportunity to feed a better kind of diet.
Were you feeling unsatisfied at work anyway? And did that help to bring you to this decision?
Absolutely. Pretty much I was unsatisfied with work my whole life, which is probably a really sad statement, right? I enjoyed different parts of different jobs that I'd had over the years, and I'm very grateful for the experiences that I had. I mean, the sales experience that I had working with specialty stores selling fashion, you know, really directly correlates to what I'm doing now, which is selling to upscale specialty boutiques. So it's really, and the buyer is even the same. You know, it's demographically, it's a woman 35 plus, you know, with a certain amount of disposable income. So it's, I haven't even switched buyers. And consumers are a little different. But yeah.
So part of the impetus for starting this business was not feeling satisfied in your current job. But how did you really make that leap to say, okay, I am going to start this business and take this chance? Were you doing it simultaneously while you were at work?
No, unfortunately, I didn't do it that way, and I wouldn't recommend doing it the way I did it. I think I'm trying to remember exactly how it went. Actually, I think I was fired from a job. It was really my last job in fashion.
That helps.
And when I was fired, I knew the jig was up. Like, that was it. There's no going back. And I remember I packed up my stuff, and I was walking down 7th Avenue, and I thought, you know what? Probably not coming back.
Yeah. Interesting that it at the time of your firing, you knew that this was actually a good thing for you. Was there any kind of depressive scenario before?
Always depressing when you get fired. It's a very depressing situation to be fired. It doesn't feel good to be fired. It really doesn't. Even though it wasn't the right situation for me, I mean, actually my last job in fashion was working for a woman that did fur accessories. And there were, like, you know, pelts hanging in the closet, and it was creepy. And so what I was doing selling it is really testament to where I had gone in my life. I mean, I've sold out. I really sold out.
And ironic that you went from selling furs to selling products to keep dogs healthy.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's, an all-natural raw pet food company. Marie started the company in 2003, and Stella and Chewy's products are available in over 500 stores around the country. So what did you do? What were some of the first steps you took in getting this business off the ground?
you know, I thought about it a lot. I thought I probably spent way too much time thinking about it. I wanted to do it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I felt it was very important to have a very strong business plan and to have, you know, certain amount of capital raised and to have this and this and this. And, you know, it just never lined up like that. I just never got it together to write the business plan. And there was somebody that was willing to co-pack the diet for me. You know, I designed a label quickly and basically had the food brought from Wisconsin to my apartment in New York on the Upper West Side. And that's really how it started. And I'm glad I didn't wait much longer.
Could you afford to have done all that thinking? Because you weren't earning an income while you were kind of planning out your next steps.
No. No, I couldn't afford to do it the way I did it. And that is why it was a mistake to do it that way. A big, big mistake.
Now, is it co-packer a manufacturer of foods?
Yes.
Okay. How did you find this co-packer or food manufacturer in Wisconsin while you were living in New York?
I'm from Wisconsin originally, and my family is there. Mm. So I go back to I had been going back and forth a lot anyway to visit my family.
Did you dictate to this co-packer exactly what ingredients should go in this food?
Yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What were those ingredients? What are those ingredients?
Those ingredients are basically it's raw meat. It's all antibiotic-free and hormone-free. There's no added hormones or anything. It's free range. And it's organic vegetables and some ground bone. Mm. So it's really like what the animal would eat, you know, in a prey model.
Right. Did you try making some of the food yourself in your Upper West Side apartment in New York?
I did. And for a long time, that is how I made Stella and Chewy's food, as I would go to Whole Foods. I would have my grocery cart, and it would be overflowing with, like, meat. And I'm a vegetarian, personally, which is, you know. And so I would have all these things of meat in the cart. And I was always so afraid I was going to run into somebody I knew, right? They'd say, I thought you were a vegetarian. I mean, I had more meat in that cart. You could hardly push it for all the meat that was overflowing. So that's how I would do it. And then I would make it ahead of time, and I'd freeze it, and then he'd have a week's worth.
Were you using your dogs as focus groups?
They are always the focus group. They are always, and they continue to be the focus group. If my dogs won't eat it, then I wouldn't put it on the market because both of them are picky eaters, so I'm fortunate in that. So I know if they eat it, and especially if they show excitement, then I've got something that's great.
Yeah. Now, where were you keeping all of this food all this frozen food that you were making?
It wasn't until I started getting the shipments from Wisconsin and I knew there was going to be a semi pulling up on 83rd Street that I wasn't going to be able to fit all this frozen food in my freezer. So I went out and I bought an industrial freezer. And the trucks, first of all, it's a nightmare to try to get them to come into Manhattan. They avoid Manhattan. They want you to meet them out in Jersey or whatever it is. But I had no way to take delivery of all this frozen food I didn't have a car. So there was no way I could do it. So I finally get this driver to come into Manhattan. He's on 83rd Street. It's like 5:30 in the morning, you know, and so I go downstairs in the elevator and I'm like loading up all these boxes, trying to get them in the elevator so that I can get them upstairs so that I can unpack them and put them in my industrial freezer in my living room, literally. I mean, I eventually moved out to Brooklyn and into a loft in Red Hook where I ended up with 8 of them.
What did your neighbors think of you marching this industrial freezer and all of this frozen dog food up your elevator, up your stairs? Did they know what was going on?
They were so happy. They were so excited because it was a building that allowed dogs, obviously, because Stella and Chewy were there. And so people were really excited about it. You know, I would give people stuff to try and their dogs would love it. And so people were excited about it.
So they didn't think you were weird or anything like that.
That's ever really tell you when they think you're weird? I don't know.
Good
they
answer.
Probably did.
Now, what were you doing in terms of distributing? Did you have any customers at the time or how long did it take you to get your first customer?
Well, actually, I think I got my first customer the next day. I remember after I took the food up and put it in this industrial freezer, I ran out of space in that freezer. And it was – so I had really to get rid of some of this food pretty quickly. So I was on the Upper West Side, and there were a couple stores, pet stores on the Upper West Side. And I remember I went into one of them, and I asked him if he would have any interest in taking in this sort of food. And he was actually one of only 2 stores in Manhattan at that time that had a freezer and was carrying, you know, a couple of brands of frozen food. There were 2 or 3 at the time in the whole country and 2 stores in all of Manhattan. And he said, you know, I really don't think I'm interested. I'm not so sure. I said, well, why don't you just take it? You know, I was literally just giving, just try it, see if anybody would want it. I mean, just sell it for what, you know, or give it to people. And, you know, I convinced him to take a couple bags of it. And then after that, I remember the first time he called me a couple weeks later and ordered like 8 cases. And I remember it was, you know, at the time maybe it was a $400 order, right? But I was so excited. It was my first order.
Now, you mentioned he has a freezer, which was already a head start for you.
Right.
When you convince other stores to take your food, do you then also have to convince them to install a freezer?
Yes. And that is part of really what was, at the time, that was what was really challenging about Manhattan and really continues to be with the rest of the country as well. Retail, obviously, it goes by, you know, how much money you can make per square foot. And so a lot of people don't want to put a freezer and, you know, they're not sure. I mean, how are people going to take their frozen food, et cetera? How do you convince somebody to take a freezer in? How do you convince somebody to buy one? Well, pretty much when I was starting out, you couldn't, you know, so I had to give them a freezer. Mm-hmm. So I had to borrow money. I remember I borrowed $50,000from I borrowed it from my father. Mm-hmm. And he was none too happy to give it to me. Actually, his exact words were, "Do you know how much goddamn dog food you're going to have to sell to pay me back?" And when I was building my plant this spring, I said, "I sold a lot of goddamn dog food, huh?" Aww. He laughed. Basically, I took the money and I put freezers into most of the stores in Manhattan that would take one. And Manhattan continues to be one of our strongest markets for the food.
So luckily, because you were giving freezers away and sometimes mm-hmm. giving dog food away, mm-hmm. You were getting your food into stores. And what was the customer response? Did it take some time for people to take to this new product?
Yes, it definitely did. I spent a lot of time standing on the sidewalks in front of these stores handing out samples. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, though, once people tried the food, they would come back and buy it. Because it is highly palatable.
Mm.
So the dogs really like it because it is what they're meant to eat. I mean, you wouldn't see a dog foraging in a cornfield, right? You'd see it hunting.
How did you make deliveries around Manhattan?
Well, that was something I hadn't really thought through so well. So here I am with this freezer full of food and nowhere to get it, no ability to get it around. So I basically took cabs. And what I would do is I would put the food. I would, you know, no cab wants to pick you up if, like, you're standing there with, like, a 10-foot, like, stack of boxes, right? So I would, like, kind of put the food in short stacks behind the cars. I would go and hail the cab. The cab would stop. I'd pop the trunk. And then I would start, like, putting these boxes in the trunk and... Yeah, and that's how I got it around in the beginning until I ended up buying, you know, I ended up buying a used minivan, actually, mm-hmm. and took out all the seats in the back and put styrofoam and plywood down. Mm-hmm. And that's how I would do all my deliveries then for the next 2 years, really.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's. We'll hear more from Marie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's, an all-natural, raw pet food company. Marie started the company in 2003, and Stella and Chewy's products are found in over 500 stores across the United States. Now, you were single at the time when
yes.
you were doing this.
No surprise, right?
And you were working out of your apartment.
Right.
Was it a lonely experience?
Was it a lonely experience? I think I was so excited by what I was doing. I really didn't think that much about being lonely or not. It was the first time in my life that I was doing something that I was really excited about that was all mine. Mm-hmm. I think probably it was the least lonely time of my life. Mm-hmm. Even though maybe I did spend a lot of time alone, I never felt lonely. No.
Yeah. Now, you met your husband or your now husband mm-hmm. while you were getting the business off the ground.
Yes.
Does he have dogs? What was his perspective on this new business?
And his whole thing was like, he always hated women that would sit and talk about their dogs and everything. So I was like, oh my God, whatever, you know. And so look how he ends up. He was working at Morgan Stanley, and we met through mutual friends. And he said something to me like, do you need help with any of your deliveries? Do you need, you know? And at the time, I was so focused on work, as I still am. I sort of thought, like, oh, I guess he wants to make some extra money. You know, it really never occurred to me that he liked me, right? And I was like, oh, I suppose. I mean, I said, what are you looking for, like, delivery work or something? Here's a guy from, like, working at Morgan Stanley. He's like, yeah, I would definitely be into that, you know, when how much you paid or whatever. So it was like, now we look back on it and we laugh.
Oh,
but that's how it started. He would come and he would load up, thank God, because it was so exhausting. It was really hard physical work, unloading these semis and then getting it in the freight elevator. At this point, I was in Brooklyn in Red Hook, you know, and there was a freight elevator. And the trucks would come at about 4:30, and he would unload the semis, get the food up to the apartment, right, and then put it, like I would always make him unpack all the boxes because I'd like to check and make sure every label was on correctly. Mm-hmm. And then he had to stack the boxes in the corner. And then he could go off to do his real job at Morgan Stanley.
Boy, you really put him through the ringer. That's how you probably knew, yeah, you wanted to spend your life with this guy.
Yeah, I guess I did put him through the ringer. I was going to say something, but I won't. He was a good sport. All throughout, he was a good sport.
And now he left his job on Wall Street at Morgan Stanley to now work with you.
Right.
How did that originate?
He saw how much passion I had for it, and he started to grow excited by the business also, because you could see, like, when you see the sales doubling and, you know, doubling over a year's time, and you see people's excitement and you get the emails from people that, wow, this food really works, my dog's so much better, thank you. And, you know, he was basically what he said. He was like, I was working at the business anyway. Yeah. Morgan Stanley was really like, I would always say, your job is so in my way. You know, can't you leave that job? And but we couldn't afford it at the time. And so it sort of became a thing. We sort of said, well, if it ever gets to this point, then maybe you would leave and come and help me. And it was always something we wanted so much, because I knew that if I had him helping me, I could go so much farther.
Sales were enough for him to leave, and you decided to actually move to Wisconsin.
Yes.
And why did you make that decision?
The reason we moved to Wisconsin is because I wanted to open up a manufacturing plant. I was getting very tired of having somebody else put the diet up for me. And as you probably, I don't know if you heard about all the recalls, when you have somebody else co-packing something for you, you can never be 100% sure of what's going into it.
Right.
And I felt like, here I am selling this high-end diet, you know, promising people it's better than anything else out there, and I don't have control from beginning to end of what's going in it.
Right.
So I felt like if I could get my own manufacturing plant and I could control everything from where I'm sourcing the ingredients to how we're putting it together to, you know, packing it and shipping it, and it would become a more viable business once we could have our own plant.
I want to go back to your husband working with you for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband is a vice president and you're the president of the company. Are there any ego issues there?
None whatsoever. He accepts his role. And it's the same thing at home. Oh, God, he's going to hear this, right? No, he, like I said, he's been such a good sport about everything. He really has. And, you know, it really was my dream, my creation. And it is because of him that we've gotten to this, you know, well, it's because of both of us. We work really well together. We are working together. We are 100% a team, like absolutely 100%. You know, we're very good at different things. He's very good at, like, being at the plant at 8:15 every morning and, you know, making sure everything's running and the day-to-day, checking in on stores. And I'm more, you know, I like to go for my run in the morning and I like to think about and strategize and visualize, like, where I see the company going. And, you know, so we're very good at different things.
I'm Jessica Harris and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's, an all-natural, raw pet food company. Now, you talk about the need for control over your product. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it really did take you 3-4 years to come to that need to control your product. How is it that you are so kind of loose about that issue for those first 3 years, do you think?
Do you know, it wasn't so much that I was loose about it. It actually tortured me. It really did. I hated not having control of it. But it's very hard as a new company, as a new product, to be able to afford the manufacturing part of that. It's equipment, it's overhead, it's labor, it's everything else. And I mean, it could cost you basically to run a plant for 1 week what your sales revenue is for, you know, 3 months when you're starting out. And that's really if you're lucky. Mm. That's if you even sell anything.
You talk about it being expensive, and luckily you did borrow $50,000 from your father. Have you paid him back yet?
I pay him back every month with interest, and it's my favorite check to write.
Now, to open up this plant, did you raise money from venture capitalists or from banks? How have you funded this process?
I really wanted to keep it, I wanted to keep control of the company. I wanted it to be my own company, so I didn't want to bring in investors. So what I did is I borrowed money from a bank with an SBA loan.
Now, was it easy borrowing money from a bank? How many banks did you go to before somebody said, yes, we'll lend you money?
Do you know, actually, I only went to one bank and I got a yes the first time out. And I know that that's fairly unusual, and that certainly hasn't been the case for me like my whole life leading up to this. I mean, I've been the person that could never get a credit card. I had an outstanding student loan. I mean, of course, that's since been paid. But do you know, I mean, I was always the person. I was single my whole life, and so I was always struggling. I was living in Manhattan as a single woman. That's hard. That's really hard and very expensive. And so I never had great credit.
Did credit card companies turn you down?
Yes. Absolutely, every single one of them. I had since built my credit back up before. And that is actually really an important thing for people to understand. If you're thinking about starting your own business or you might ever hope to, really make sure your credit is as strong as it possibly can be, because that could be the difference between you being able to go to a bank and borrowing money or having to bring in an investor and losing half of the company right from the get-go.
How much money did you borrow from the bank?
About $500,000.
And you also have brought your in-laws, your mother and father-in-law, into this. They are co-signers of the loan. And how is that dynamic? It's one thing to borrow money from your parents, but then to bring your in-laws into it. Does that add any complication or?
Not really. I mean, it's just, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, the business is clearly working. The business model clearly works. Mm-hmm. So it's just that with growth comes the need for more capital. And, you know, I think that it's taking me a while to become comfortable with that idea. You know, the more we grow, probably the more capital we're going to need in order to continue to grow, because then you've got to have, you know, money for raw goods, money to inventory the stuff, money for sales reps, money to be able to, if you really want to be a national brand, it's an expensive endeavor.
How are you about asking people for money?
I hate it. I hate it. I hate it so much. I don't like it. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that men probably have an easier time of it than women, in terms of men are able to. I remember I used to date this guy, and he was always raising money for these businesses, and none of them ever worked, right? And like the last time I talked to him, he just lost his last friend's 70 grand or what. It was always like, what do you mean you go to your friends and like, you know, I don't care how much money they have. How can you lose other people's money? Like, I can't even fathom it, like how painful that would be. And I don't think, you know, he was always like, well, that's business. I mean, he knew he could either lose money or make a lot. That's business. I mean, it was only, 1978 before women could even borrow money on their own. Right?
Exactly.
Before you could even get a credit card in your own name and not your husband's name.
Exactly.
God forbid.
Could you imagine?
No, I can't.
So going back to this this new manufacturing facility in Wisconsin, were there any startup pains surrounding this manufacturing plant?
There were so many. I really wouldn't even know where to begin. The equipment was 5 months late. So I was sitting in a 12,000 square foot plant with nothing in it and a plant manager and, you know, salaries to pay and orders to fill, and I had no way to make them. So that was definitely something that I hadn't anticipated.
Did you go back to your prior manufacturer and have them manufacture it in the meantime?
For a little while, until they found out that I was opening my own plant, and then spitefully they cut me off, which, whatever.
What else for you was...
Well, I mean, there's little things like I remember the first day we finally got the patty maker in and running, the electric running and everything else. And I hadn't really thought through much past what would happen after they came out of the patty maker, after the food came off of the patty makers. And did you ever see that Lucille Ball at the candy factory, right?
I love
that
scene.
And like all those chocolates are coming out. Well, picture like little hamburgers, right, coming off of this patty maker. We didn't have a conveyor belt after the patty maker. And so we were like, they were coming out and the guys were putting them on trays, right? And so, but they were coming off so quickly and like the trays are stacking up and, you know, we ran out of trays. And so then we decided, I don't remember who had this bright idea. It was probably me. I said, well, we'll stack them. We'll stack them with wax paper. Right. So I went and I got all the wax paper that I could possibly buy down the street. I come back and like I'm ripping these sheets of wax paper as quickly as like they can, you know, like layer them. So the next morning, so then we put them all in the blast freezer. They freeze overnight. And, you know, we have a big order. I mean, we have so many orders at this point. We're so behind. And you have to picture people working 12, 14 hours, like everybody trying to do their best to get this big order out. And so we go to unpeel the patties so that they can start packaging them. They were I had bought one-sided wax paper.
Oh, no.
Yes. I nearly had a mutiny on my hands, really. I thought everybody was just going to walk out.
So you talk about patties. Is that the form in which you sell the food?
Yes. Basically, they look like little mini hamburgers.
What is some of the feedback from your customers? I mean, you're in New York today, and you're meeting with some of the vets that carry your food and some of the pet stores. What are they saying to you of what needs to be improved?
The feedback has been really positive. And the dogs themselves and the cats love it. Mm. So, I mean, I have a lot of people that call it like doggy crack. It's really highly palatable because when you freeze dry it especially, you lose the moisture. So that's all that's left is just the meat. And I think it smells amazing to them.
What about some of the negative components?
I was told actually today by one of my important stores on the Upper West Side that I must focus more on cats. In fact, when we first started, I had a cat food, but it was with the dog. I don't know if you know our logo is the two dogs. They're the two heads, right? And I had somebody write in and say, how dare you? How dare you put a cat food out with two dogs on it? Basically, we hate people like you that like are so dog-centric, and you'd best do something if you ever hope to have a single cat person buy your food. I was like, my God, we're getting like hate mail, right? So I did design a label with two cat heads on it.
Was there one customer that really made a difference in your sales?
Not so much. It's mainly small specialty stores. And then there are a couple of chains that we sell to, but they're not like Petco's or PetSmart. I mean, we can't sell to the big chains. Otherwise, then the specialty stores don't want it. So we are very careful like who we sell it to.
Do you think that you would ever cross the line and sell to a more mass market?
So, you know, not under this label, we couldn't. Mm. We couldn't because what ends up happening with things like that as soon as you go mass, it sort of loses its specialness and people don't, like the specialty stores would drop it. I can't imagine selling to a Petco. And not only that, I think that the people that would shop there, until something really becomes mainstream, it really would be to your disadvantage to be in those stores anyway.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's, an all-natural raw pet food company. Marie started the company in 2003, and Stella and Chewy's products are available in over 500 stores around the country. Raw food is a little controversial in the pet world. Why is that?
Right. It's controversial. It's controversial because I think the word raw is sort of maybe not the best adjective. I think that people hear raw and they think immediately somehow, they don't think necessarily fresh, wholesome, uncooked. They think more like scary, like pathogens, salmonella, E. coli. I think that that's been where some of the controversy with the raw feeding has come in is there are, you know, some of the conventional vets and such have been sort of hesitant to recommend raw diets because they're afraid of the salmonella and the E. coli and things like that. Mm. That are
now, you have a process called hydrostatic high pressure, mm-hmm. which gets rid of all of those bacterial elements.
That's correct, actually. We are the first raw food company in the United States to be offering a pathogen-free pet food.
And how exactly does hydrostatic high pressure process work?
Well, it's sort of akin to at the bottom of the ocean, you have life, but you don't have bacteria. You don't have vegetative bacteria. So you put the food in these chambers and the water comes and the water compresses. And it's the pressure of the water that actually kills the vegetative bacteria.
How did you learn about the fact that there's not much bacteria at the bottom of the ocean?
I hired the best food safety person in the United States.
You're just like this little encyclopedia of food knowledge.
Of bacteria, right.
You're coming in at a kind of auspicious time in the pet food world because a lot of the large food manufacturers have faced difficulty with their product recall. Some of the food is manufactured in China.
Exactly.
And tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, what's going on in food safety right now in our country? I think that with all the recalls, people are really getting concerned. You know, there's three or four companies making all the major pet food brands, for example. So the same person is making the Old Roy that's making the high-end boutique-y pet food. And, you know, it's the same ingredients nearly. It was certainly in the same plant, and that's how the cross-contamination occurs. And I think that people are really looking for companies that are doing things in-house, that are traceable, that are, you know, accountable for mm-hmm. what they're putting out on the market. We test every batch. We post our test results actually online so a consumer can go to their package and they can match their batch number with their test result online and see from an independent lab that this food has passed laboratory testing. You know, we only source our ingredients in the U.S. We have nothing, not one vitamin, not anything from China.
Which means that your costs are, of course, a little higher as well.
Our costs are a lot higher,
yeah.
Actually.
And how does that translate to prices?
It's higher.
Yeah,
it's higher. But I can promise you that it's better.
Yeah. Now, talk to me about the humanization of pets. I mean, people spend as much money on their pets as they do themselves to some degree. I mean,
right.
They are they are like a second child.
It's true. You know, I think about it a lot. Like, why is this happening? It's more, see, to me, when I hear the humanization of pets, I actually think it goes even further than that, though. I mean, there are people that are more concerned with what they feed their pets than even what they feed their children. A classic example, we're at my brother-in-law's and he's barbecuing, right? And he's putting hot dogs on the grill. You know, the kids are eating, right? And he says, oh, don't give that to the dog as Jasmine. Don't give that to Jasmine. There's nitrates in that. Like, what? You're kidding, right? You're afraid to give the dog nitrates, but you're feeding it to the kids. And it's that sort of thinking, like people are very concerned with what they give their dogs. It must be organic. They must be free range. I think that the reason that people are so attached to their pets, could it be because, I don't know.
Perhaps it's because pets don't talk back.
Well, that's another thing. You can make them their children forever,
yes.
Right?
It's funny. We think about spending so much money on our dogs and really they're money-losing ventures, even though we're so in love with them. But in this case, Della and Chewy's were quite the revenue generators for you.
I suppose they were, but that doesn't take into account all the furniture Stella ruined when she was a puppy.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
My guest has been Marie Moody, founder of Stella and Chewy's. Coming up, we'll meet Sam Farber, founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. Sam also founded another cookware company in 1960 called Kopko with products of enameled cast iron and enameled steel. Sam's career has been about designing universal human-centric products for all ages and capacities. So a carrot peeler that works for a 30-year-old should also work comfortably for a 70-year-old with arthritis. OXO sells over 500 products and has extended beyond the kitchen to the garden and the barbecue. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You started OXO at what stage of your life?
I was 65 years old. I had retired in 1988 from Kopko. And one of my dreams had always been to go and live in France for a while. So Betsy, my wife and I, rented a house in Provence and spent 2 months of the year for 3 years there.
So what was the catalyst then for leaving retirement and starting OXO?
We do cook a lot. And one of the days, Betsy turned to me and said, why can't somebody make a kitchen tool that's comfortable? Betsy has some arthritis in her hands. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. And so the first thing we did, actually, was to go and buy some clay, some modeling clay, and put it around the handles of the various tools we could find in the stores in France. Made them larger. We had a whole refrigerator full of handles with modeling clay on them. And finally decided that it was a good idea. And so I got on the phone and called David Stoll, who was head of smart design and with whom I'd worked before, and said, "I have this wonderful idea, David. I think it's a good idea. Let me run it by you." And I spoke to him about the idea of making a line of kitchen tools with a soft, comfortable handle. It wasn't just the comfortable handle. We wanted a good product that was easy to use, that was dishwasher safe, and fairly well priced, we hope. As it turned out, there were peelers selling for 99 cents. We came out at $5.99, I believe, and people looked at it and said, "Oh, no one will ever pay that price for a peeler." Well, they paid it.
Were you itching at all to start a business, or were you kind of content in your retirement?
I think I was itching to start a business. A very good question. I enjoyed myself, but I think somewhere deep inside was this knowledge that I wasn't going to retire and ski and play tennis or do something else.
So what did you do to come up with that first peeler?
Well, the first thing we did was to observe people using kitchen tools. And because we were interested in doing it for a wide body of consumers, we didn't want to make a prosthetic device for a few people. We wanted to make something that everybody could use. It was called universal design at that point. They study people with the New York Arthritis Society. And then the other end of the spectrum, they studied chefs working with it.
Did you have a problem with marketing because people thought that it was just a geriatric product?
No, I think the problem we had in marketing may have been more than getting used to a very fat handle. It was different from all other handles, and also probably some price sensitivity.
Now, you have a material on your products that looks like rubber, but it's actually called santoprene. What is santoprene?
It's a combination of polypropylene and rubber, actually. I know it was used in the automotive field. We were the first ones to use it in our field, actually. So many people copied us afterwards and used it in the field for everything.
Now, how did you go about manufacturing the product?
I knew someone who had a factory in New Jersey making the bicycle handles, which had the same idea in many ways because they had the thin fins at the top of the handle that we had. And the engineers looked at it and said, "We can't do it. It can't be made. Those fins are too thin. We'll never get a decent product out of it." Being an entrepreneur and having an idea and then you never stop because you want to see that idea come to fruition, I got in touch with people I'd worked with in Japan, and the owner of the factory in Japan looked at it and said, "Very interesting. Surely we can do it." And they did it easily.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company of transgenerational products that are easy to use. OXO has won many awards, including from the Arthritis Foundation, and OXO's Good Grips have been selected for permanent collections at the Museum of Modern Art, among others. Now, before you started OXO, you actually had a career in cooking and kitchenware.
I decided I wanted to go into something in the home area. I had been working in a family business for 9 years. We got along well, but that it wasn't where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. I wanted to be on my own. I was on a train to a Harvard-Yale game and was talking about going into business, and the wife of my college roommate said, "Why doesn't someone make a beautifully designed line of cast iron cookware? There isn't such a thing. It's all traditional, and no one does it in modern design." Marvin Traub, who was at Bloomingdale's at the time and later became chairman of Bloomingdale's, said, "That's a wonderful idea. Why don't you go and see the buyer in our gourmet department?" Which I did. He was excited about it, and I decided to make it. So I investigated and got in touch with people I knew in Europe and went to Europe and visited a number of factories. A designer in Denmark, Acton Bjorn, told me about a factory in northern Denmark, and I made an appointment, went to see them, and I got there, and it was a marvelous old factory. They said they could do it. After a year, we finally managed to get a product.
How adventurous. This was in 1960. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Yonkers, New York.
What was the state of design, at least in the houseware field in 1960, when you were first starting out? What was design?
It was a desert. People were just set in their ways, well, what they did, and they thought that by changing a color, they changed the design, actually.
Do you think it had anything to do with a lot of people coming out of the Depression era and after World War II, or?
Well, I think that that might have some bearing upon it, because when World War II ended, there was a hungry market there. And so you didn't have to worry about making great advances in design and innovation, let's say, in general. So there may have been a number of years where people sat back and just said, well, we can sell everything we make. Look at the car industry. That's a perfect example of it, you know. They were there so far. They just went on doing the same thing they'd done. And finally, they lost out, as they're losing out now, to people who thought about design. I drive a Prius, Toyota Prius, and it's wonderful.
Speaking of things related to World War II, you were in World War II.
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm.
Where did you serve?
Majority of time in North Africa, and Libya, and southern Turkey. I was not in combat. Everyone who was there just wanted to go home, actually. But I did have it easy, I must say. I can't complain about the time. It was just a lot out of your life, really. For instance, when I came back to college, I had a lot of credits. If I'd had to do over again, I wouldn't have taken those credits. Mm-hmm. I would have stayed in college and gone through a normal college education. Mm-hmm. This way I was just sort of floating around trying to get out of college mm-hmm. at the time.
Where did you go to college?
Harvard.
And what did you think you were doing when you got out of college?
Well, first of all, I thought when I went into college that I would be a lawyer. And I did go to Harvard Law School for two semesters. Sitting one day in a contracts class, I said to myself, why am I here? I'm bored. And went on training program at Abraham & Strauss, a department store in Brooklyn at that time. I decided I would go with a family business. It was more lucrative at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. Now, we keep talking about human-centered designs and universal designs. What does that mean?
Well, it basically is considering the broadest spectrum of the populace when you make the design.
What are some examples of consumers who have benefited from these universal designs?
We used to get a lot of letters from people thanking us for making OXO peelers and OXO products. One of the ones that we remember very well is the woman who said that she gave a peeler to her grandmother, and the grandmother was able, it was a spoon actually, not a peeler, one of our mixing spoons, and that the grandmother was able to make brownies for the first time in many years for her grandchildren.
Did you have any issues with competition once you presented these products to the market? Would people try to copy OXO?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Within 6 months, there were other products in the market that were copying of OXO, loads of them. When it was possible, we did sue. We won some cases, or so people folded before the cases, actually.
It seems like lawsuits or the notion of litigation gives me such a headache, and it's such an expensive process. Mm. Did you ever feel like, oh, I don't necessarily want to spend the money, and maybe we should just go head-to-head with them? Or were you adamant about going to court with them?
We were somewhat adamant, but again, we were a tiny company with limited resources, and that's, of course, the larger companies take advantage of that because they know you won't sue because you can't afford all the money to go to court, really. So you sue where you really, really, really know you're going to win. For instance, we had a company in Canada who actually copied it, the peeler exactly, but they made the mistake of photographing our peeler for their package.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. And it showed there was a slight difference of some kind, and they just folded right away. I mean, they knew that, and we sent us $150,000 immediately. And that's a case where you would sue. But there were the cases where the borderline cases, you were hesitant to sue, really. So the really best way was to do what I've said many times, is to compete basically by doing innovative product and doing it quickly, ahead of the market all the time. And that's what OXO does today.
Now, when you say about doing it quickly, you mean being the first mover, getting out there before other people. Some people say that being the first mover is actually a disadvantage because you don't have time to work out the kinks. And the second guy to come along, as you say, gets the cheese.
The second mouse gets the cheese.
There we go.
I don't believe in it, really. Basically, what happens is that the market gets to know that you're the people to look to for a new product. Look what's come out of OXO over the past few years. There's a marvelous salad spinner. A great story behind it, if I may tell it.
Please.
We mentored projects in graduate business schools at Harvard and Babson primarily, where you put together designers, business school people, and if you can, engineers. The salad spinner came out of a project at Babson. One of the business school people was playing with a Fisher-Price toy, I believe. You press up and down a top or something like that, and got excited about it and said, we can actually make the salad spinner this way. And that's where it came from. That the innovative product, way ahead of the market all the time. And so you build a brand that way. OXO did no advertising. It was primarily about people buying one OXO product and realizing that all OXO products were very unusual and satisfied their needs.
I read an interesting story about when OXO entered Japan. The products seemed so big to the consumer. In fact, the salad spinner was called a restaurant-sized salad spinner because, you know, they use products that are much smaller. They hold a spatula like a pen, whereas Americans hold a spatula like a tennis racket.
Yes, that's true.
So OXO had to kind of re-innovate to fit that market.
That would have been after my time, certainly. But it brings up another interesting part of the design world, which is the cultural aspect. In thinking about design, you take into consideration the physical, the cognitive. We're working on the emotional right now. You want design to give you a feeling of joy and accomplishment, not fear, anger, and frustration, actually. And so we're just sort of thinking a lot about that right now. And the cultural fits in with that as well.
What is your interaction with design on a daily basis?
I think about design. I was going to write a book with Patricia Moore, who's a designer and gerontologist. We haven't gotten around to it yet. It was called Ouch, Bad Design Hurts. And when you went through the entire day and pointing out bad design, I'll give you for instance of that. You wake up in the morning, your alarm clock rings, you can't find the button to turn it off. Now, why can't someone's going to make it after I say this, of course, why can't there be one big red light that pops up in the dark so you can turn it off? And as you go through the whole day and you're a design thinker, and that's what I do, and go in the bathroom and see everything wrong in that bathroom. It's fascinating.
What is wrong in that bathroom? What's an example?
Oh, well, they still have, you know, round knobs on doors, so when you come out with the slippery hands, you can't turn the knob around, for instance. That's a typical thing in the bathroom. As you go in the kitchen, we bought a toaster oven a few years ago, and it had a round white dial on it. And the marking where it was the arrow was a little faint indentation in it, and I couldn't see it. And so Betsy went in the bathroom, got her red nail polish, and made that into a red dot so I could see it at that point. And you can't imagine why a designer would design something like that. They're not thinking about the user at that point. And to me, it's very fascinating.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. You really incorporated your family into the business, into OXO. What role did your wife and your son play in the business?
Well, Betsy looked over my shoulder in the room that we were using for a year as we were getting going. So she became part of it. She is an architect, along with being many other things, poet. So she did the PR, worked on the packaging and the printed material in general. And when I started the company, my son John, who was in Wall Street at that time, was very fascinated by it and was an investor in it. When we showed in San Francisco, he came to see what was going on and got so excited about it that he decided to leave Wall Street and join us.
Some people might be reluctant to bring family members into the business just because of all the complicated relationships that might result. What were your feelings about that?
I'd worked for my father, who was a very wonderful guy, loved him dearly, but I disagreed with him most of the time. And I thought that it was not great to have family in the business and didn't invite my sons into the business at any time. We got along. It was okay, but it certainly there are. I don't really feel that you can isolate the emotional aspects, family emotional aspects, from your daily life and business, and that's a problem that you face. John and I are still together. We still do consulting. If I did it over again, well, if they wanted to come, I would say, I welcome them in, but I don't think it's great. Other people can manage it very well, really. Mm-hmm. It may be my personality that doesn't manage it, really. So Betsy and I manage it with a little family therapy, and it worked out quite well, actually.
You mentioned before we were talking about universal design and it appealing to a broader spectrum of the populace. Mm-hmm. You also are very interested in outsider art, mm-hmm. which in a way also incorporates the broader spectrum of the populace. What is outsider art?
We're still working on that. It's the same question as what is design, but basically, it's art done by untrained artists, self-taught artists, who may be institutionalized, may isolates, eccentrics, being obsessives, although, you know, mainstream artists have some of this themselves. I mean, they're obsessed with obsession and passionate, get very close together, you know. But there is a certain otherness about it, let's say, is the word we use, really. I became very passionate about outsider art when I first saw it. I saw it in England in a house, a woman who was an agent for a mainstream artist that I was interested in. And I said, what is that? I'm fascinated by it. It moved me tremendously. And I started to find out about outsider art.
And in your retirement, you spent a lot of time on your interest in outside art. You had a Soho studio.
And being an entrepreneur, I opened a gallery with Rosa Esmond, who had a mainstream gallery in Soho. We ran it for about 2 years. And it was marvelous. It was great fun. We were one of the early people in it, not the earliest, but one of the early people in the field, did wonderful exhibits. And then I realized that you can't keep losing money all the time, so I stopped.
So then you decided to make money by starting OXO.
Shortly after. You're right. That's about 5 years later, actually, when it mattered to me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
My guest has been Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.